This is Radio West. I'm Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of the show, here with another staff pick from our archives. One of the things we try to do on the show is challenge conventional wisdom and bust sacred cows. When it comes to diet and nutrition, no cow has been more sacred than the low-fat diet. It's defined how we eat in this country since at least the 1950s. And when the journalist Nina Teicholz pored over the science supporting the low-fat diet, she found it to be pretty flimsy. What she has to say about dietary fat and health radically changed my approach to eating. Now, like my grandfather did, I eat all the fat on my plate. And the new diet seems to be working, judging, that is, by my recent cholesterol scores. The doctor called them stellar. Thanks, Nina. Here's the show.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Nina Teicholz's book has been getting a lot of attention for what seems like the audacity of this idea that the foods that we've always thought of as forbidden, like whole-fat dairy and eggs and fatty red meat, are, here's how she puts it, necessarily part of a healthy diet. For going on 60 years now, the conventional thinking has been that a low-fat diet, one with lots of whole grains, would fight heart disease and obesity and diabetes. But Teicholz has spent nearly a decade poring over the studies and the research, and she says it's pretty clear now. The low-fat diet has been terrible for people in pretty much every conceivable way. Her book explores how we came to this way of thinking. It's complicated, she says. Part of it is about money and personal ambition, but really it comes down to just bad science. These researchers and nutritional scientists had good intentions, but she says they jumped the gun. They let their biases get the best of them. They shouted down the critics, and they made official recommendations, recommendations we've been following forever, long before they could get the science just right. Today in the program, Nina Teicholz is joining us to talk about her book. It's called The Big Fat Surprise, Why Butter, Meat, and Cheese Belong in a Healthy Diet. Nina Teicholz has written for The New Yorker, for The New York Times, The Economist, among others. And she's joining us today from a studio in New York City. And Nina Teicholz, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Well, I wanted to begin with something that you've talked about, and that is, it's funny, it's like you say you kind of pinpoint the day when you stopped worrying about eating fat.
You know, when I started out this whole investigative journey, I was basically a near vegetarian and had been for decades. It's so counterintuitive to think really that these foods that we've so long been told are our dietary culprits might be okay to eat or even good for us.
Right.
So I do remember the day that I looked at cream sauce on red meat and said, I'm not going to fear the fat.
Right.
Which, you know, is what most of us think. And it came about initially because I had a little side job reviewing restaurants for a little paper, and it didn't have the budget to pay for meals. So I just had to accept whatever the chef decided to send out to me. And that was not stir-fried vegetables and chicken breasts, I discovered, but things like red meat, creamy sauces, cheese, foie gras, pâté, things I had really almost never eaten in my adult life. And I found them to be rich, earthy, textured, delicious, interesting. And miraculously, I soon lost this stubborn 10 pounds I had been fighting despite exercising constantly for most of my adult life. And my next time I went to my doctor, he said my cholesterol levels looked absolutely fine. So that presented this extraordinary mystery to me that then took, as you said, nearly a decade to unpack and understand.
You get this assignment from an editor at Gourmet, and that's the thing sort of that gets you started. You describe, and I guess it's fair to say it this way, you became kind of obsessed with the subject.
I did. It's an easy subject to become obsessed about. You know, it's everybody eats every day. It's hard not to be obsessed. And the idea that our health authorities had gotten it so wrong seemed so impossible to believe, such a big, you know, story in journalistic terms that that I really became obsessed with understanding the details of all that science. I mean, what's so particularly interesting is going back, when you go back and research all the original science, mm-hmm. you know, we can talk about that in detail, but one of the things that you see is how hard scientists come, they're straining to try to support the idea that a low-fat diet is good for health. And you see how the science itself becomes distorted because everybody is on this low-fat bandwagon. So going back and researching all those early original studies that had been used to support these ideas was just fascinating and obsessive, yes.
Yeah. You don't you sort of give scientists a bit of a break in the beginning because you say we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that there is a noble element even to this kind of clumsy science. I mean, they did have this, you know, passionate desire to cure heart disease in this country. And I guess that has to account for something. I mean, they did have good intentions.
That is so true. Heart disease had been almost non-existent in the early 1920s and had risen to become this terrifying number one killer in America by the 1950s. And there was really a desperate search for answers. And scientists responded to that by, you know, one of the possibilities was that it was saturated fat and fat. And in those days, nutrition science was still an entirely new field. Nutrition science is very hard to do. It's hard to measure people's diets. It's hard to find out what they eat from day to day. And then it's hard to link that up with diseases that evolve over the course of your entire life.
Yeah.
It's very hard to connect those dots. So there was the whole field of this science was in its very early stages, and yet there was this pressing, urgent public health need to solve this problem.
Well, people were freaking out. I mean, President Eisenhower had this, you know, he had a couple of heart attacks. His first one in 1955, and people are like, what is going on, I guess?
Right, and he's out of the Oval Office for 10 days.
Yeah.
So everybody's attention was just focused, exclusively on this public health problem. And that's really where poor science was kind of made to suffice, right? The scientists basically jumped the gun. I mean, I can tell you the story about how that first happened with Ansel Keys, who is he was a pathologist from the University of Minnesota. He was the first one to suggest in that urgent climate that it was saturated fats that would cause your total cholesterol to go up and therefore give you a heart attack. That was his idea.
Yeah.
And he was this very outsized, charismatic, kind of aggressive personality who was able to get that idea implanted into the American Heart Association. So our very first anti-saturated fat dietary guidelines were published in 1961. That really set the whole ball rolling for the next 60 years.
I want to come back to that because I do want to break down one of the studies that is crucial to his way of thinking, which you went through, had a hard time finding, but once you did, you found all kinds of flaws, and I want to break that down as we go. But I also want to say, you make this argument that we have lost an historical perspective about food traditions. And you mention that there are, as you say in the book, something like 4,000 years of history here. We've got all these cookbooks and diaries and accounts from, you know, anthropologists that show animal foods made up the core of the human diet. But then there's that counter argument, you know, that, yeah, fine, we ate a lot of meat back then, but we also died when we were 36 and, you know, our life expectancy is better now. We're more enlightened people. We're more humane in the way we treat, you know, animals, those kinds of things. But we've lost track of food traditions, and I think that's an important point for you.
Yes. Well, one of the things you notice when you're reading nutrition study after nutrition study is that they will say, we have no record of any – we cannot say anything about the human diet before 1950, which was when our modern nutrition science began. Hmm. So they don't look to history. They don't look to other kinds of documents outside their own academic silo of their field. But in fact, if you go back and look at historical documents, I mean, they can be quite rigorous accounts from wills and trade accounts and all kinds of historical documents that show, you know, first of all, that the only fat or the main principal fats that were used for cooking before 1900 were butter and lard, and to a lesser extent, suet and tallow, which come from cattle. So there were no vegetable oils.
Right.
How is it possible that vegetable oils could be thought to cure heart disease when we, in the days before heart disease, we were only using animal fats to cook? And then there's strongly suggestive evidence that we were eating 3 to 4 times more red meat than we were today in the United States 150 years ago. So there's so many sources of information about what people used to eat, but it really not considered by nutrition science. So that is just a very interesting point that I try to explore. And of course, as you said, it's also true that people died earlier, but they didn't die of chronic disease. Right. They didn't die of the kinds of diseases we suffer from today. There's pretty good records that, you know, heart disease was extremely rare. So was cancer, diabetes pretty much non-existent before 1900. People died of infectious diseases. And you know, there was just a certain lack of medical care then. So but they weren't dying of the kinds of diseases that now we bear such a burden from today.
Yeah. And this is not new thinking. You do mention, in fact, I wanted to mention two particular characters that you write about. A man by the name of, and I'm going to blow this name, I'm sure, Wilhelmer Stephenson?
Stephenson.
Yes. Wilhelmer Stephenson, who went to live with the Inuit in the Canadian Arctic. Now, this is back in 1906. Talk about this guy. He's really interesting.
He was a Harvard-trained anthropologist who went off and lived with the Inuit, as you said, for years. And he found them to be the most robustly healthy people that he had ever lived with. They had a diet, as he recorded in detail, that was about 70 to 80% fat. They ate caribou. They ate seal, fish. They ate almost no fruits or vegetables at all. They would, you know, just a little bit in the springtime. And he couldn't understand that. You know, that was already true when he came back with his findings and published his book, that the low-fat diet was starting to take hold, or a diet restricted in saturated fat, at least, was starting to take hold in the United States. So he did an amazing thing. He, in 1928, he started, along with a friend, on a year-long experiment of only eating meat and fat in Bellevue Hospital in New York City, overseen by a staff of top medical experts to see if he could survive. His friends thought he would die. And there were all these press reports about how outrageous this diet was, even then, that he could only survive on meat. In fact, he was completely healthy. The only time he felt ill was when he was eating too much meat without the accompanying fat. And then he says, so I fried up some brains in oil and felt much better. And he also ate the whole animal. He didn't just eat the muscle meat that we do now, but it used to be, as recorded by anthropologists, explorers, and all kinds of accounts, that human civilizations would eat the whole animal, the kinds of things we now throw away, but, you know, liver, tripe, brains, glands, all those things, very, very nutrient dense. And he, at the end of that year, felt fine, had lost weight, and was in excellent health.
Tell us also about George Mann, because he comes into play a number of times in the story. This is later, and of course, this is the 1960s, I think it was, and he goes to Uganda.
Yes. You know, I just want to sort of put this in context. Both these examples are meant to show that there was evidence that had to be ignored
right.
in order for the low-fat hypothesis to take hold. And that's an important thing to just say, like, that one of the main themes that I write about is how this hypothesis got going, but a lot of evidence to the contrary had to be ignored. Mm-hmm. So this is just a couple of examples of that. George Mann, a biochemist from the University of Vanderbilt, went out to Africa in the 1970s, studied the Maasai warriors, also eating a diet of 70 to 80% fat. They ate only milk, blood, and meat. And they should have been, by all the contemporary thought, dying of heart attacks right and left. George Mann took electrocardiographs of 400 of them, could find almost no trace of any evidence that any of them had had a heart attack. So that was another just point of evidence to the contrary. And there were many, many others, actually, that had to be ignored. So those were really interesting examples of, you know, something called selection bias, how the health authorities, nutrition experts, had to select out the evidence that supported their hypothesis and ignore evidence to the contrary, which is really what has been going on for 60 years now.
Well, because you say in the book, good science requires that when we observe something that doesn't fit in a hypothesis, the observations need to be reckoned with. And that's kind of what was going on, I guess.
Yes. I mean, how do you account for that observation? I mean, how do you account for those people? One idea was that they had some kind of unique genetics. Mm-hmm. And so they explored that possibility. They looked at Inuit who had moved to the city. George Mann looked at Maasai warriors who had moved to Nairobi. And they found that their cholesterol levels started to look just as bad as the city dwellers there. So they did not seem to be protected by any particular genetic feature.
Yeah.
And so that was one idea. But
another idea was that they were walking for miles because they were shepherds. That had to account for it.
Right, that they were more there, they got more exercise. Actually, that was George Mann's idea, that it was the exercise that protected them. But that theory was also tested and found that that has never really proven to be well supported. You know, and here we are today. I mean, just to put it in context of our own reality, here we are with our own observation that we need to explain. We have for 30 years been following a low-fat diet. So we've reduced our fat. We've reduced our saturated fat by 11% over the last 30 years. We've increased our carbohydrates by 25% over the last 30 years. And yet we look fatter and sicker now than we did when we embarked on this low-fat diet. So how do we explain that observation today? That's another example of science needing to question itself.
When we get back from a break, I want to just start breaking down some of this science, how we came to be thinking like this. But let me ask you this first. Did you – I suppose you knew when you started writing about this what you were up against in terms of sort of the cultural bias against fat. I mean, I was the very popular food writer Michael Pollan. He's coined this saying that has become almost, you know, a sacred mantra for some. You know, eat food – not too much, mostly plants, which, you know, seems so humane and so sensible. But essentially what you're saying is that's kind of wrong. And this has got to be hard for some people to take, I guess.
You know, I was also eating mostly plants, but we have to reckon with why we're so unhealthy now. We actually eat 17% more fruits and vegetables than we did 30 years ago. So we are eating more plants. And we have to reckon with why our health has taken such a disastrous turn for the worse. I mean, we have to figure out what is going to make people healthy. The evidence behind mostly plants turns out to be quite thin. And so we just have to really look at the scientific evidence if our primary goal is to help people not suffer so much from from obesity, diabetes, and heart disease. These are like plagues upon us nowadays.
But you had to have been kind of nervous about taking on people like Michael Pollan. And I mean, what has it been like? I mean, I think I heard you once talk about the fact that when you were doing this research, they would say, look, is this the Gary Taubes idea? We've had him on this program. I mean, he's one of the sort of – he really sort of broke ground on this idea that maybe fat isn't so bad. But people have said to you, look, I'm not even going to talk to you if you're supporting that idea. I mean, it must have been tough.
It's true. You have to be a little a bit of a nonconformist to go down this path.
Yeah.
And it is true that when I started out my research in the early 2000s, the whole environment was much, much more closed than it was today. And I would get on the phone with researchers and they would say, if you're taking the Gary Taubes line, I won't even talk to you.
Right.
And sometimes I would get off the phone shaking because people had been so they were so afraid and there was so much fear and they were so angry at me from even proposing these ideas or suggesting them. You know, I would get off and I'd have to convince myself that I wasn't actually like investigating the mob or something. You know, there's so much, the climate of fear was palpable. I mean, I think the debate is now more open, but it is still, it's still a little vicious, actually. And that's one of the themes that I explore in my book is how, you know, a degree of bullying has gone on in nutrition science that I think is pretty uncommon to science in general. You know, the kind of calm, reasoned, rationed debate that you expect in science really has not been characteristic of a lot of nutrition science. There's been bullying and name calling and undermining each other's reputations and getting other people's research grants cut off. And there's a degree of viciousness that has allowed the prevailing theory to continue, but does is also a cautionary tale to young scientists trying to come up through the ranks and think differently. Certainly should have been a cautionary tale to me.
Right. Well, when you learned, I mean, there's this organic chemist, David Krzyzewski, I think is his name, who you mentioned, and we'll get back to this a little bit later in the program, but he said that some scientists who were kind of going against the conventional thinking of the time, is it true they were literally spat on?
Well, I mean, if you read the transcripts of some of the hearings and the meetings between people, there is so extremely vindictive and mean to each other. I mean, the real, really cutting and really, I mean, just to give you an idea, Ansel Keys and his colleagues, you know, when they had critics and challengers, you know, they called them scoundrels. Mm-hmm. And and there was just a degree of viciousness about in this field that is really surprising.
Okay, so back to Benjamin Ansel Keys. He's this really strong personality, a really critical player in this story. Really persuasive man. He's driving a lot of this thinking. And I think it's 1952, you say in the book, that he draws this direct line of causation from fat in the diet to cholesterol in the blood. And this is the kind of, as you say, sort of the connect the dot exercise. This is the acorn, as you put it, that grows into this giant oak tree of our fears about fat today. Talk about this, what does he call it? The diet heart hypothesis.
Right. It's sort of a two-step chain. So saturated fat would cause your total cholesterol to go up, and your high total cholesterol would give you a heart attack, or be so strongly associated with a heart attack that it could predict it. But neither of those links have proven to be true, which is to say your saturated fat intake is weakly connected to your total cholesterol, but really more importantly, your total cholesterol turned out not to be a very good predictor of heart attack risk. So when saturated fat was convicted, it was based on this very primitive understanding of heart disease, what are called biomarkers, things that predict, that you can measure, that can predict heart attack risk. And early on, when Ansel Keys proposed this diet heart hypothesis, our understanding of heart disease was so primitive. You know, we've now had 50 years of study, and we have found study after study has shown that your total cholesterol does not well predict your heart attack risk, nor does, it turns out, your LDL cholesterol well predict your heart attack risk, which is to say that a lot of people with low LDL still get heart attacks. And so it turns out that by the best, most up-to-date biomarkers that we have now, things like your LDL particle number and mm-hmm. your LDL subfraction, those look just fine, if not improved, on a diet high in fat and low in carbohydrates, including if your diet has saturated fat in it. So it seems as if we condemned saturated fat based on really premature evidence that turned out to crumble away.
Ansel Keys conducts this study that has been cited now, as you point out, tens of thousands of times. Do you call
it a million?
A million times, really? Is that right?
Yeah, over a million citations.
Wow, it's the Rosetta Stone of nutritional studies. You call it in the book. It's the seven-country study. Tell us about that.
So this is like the big bang of nutrition research. It was the first major nutrition study, and it was used to underpin that first 1961. Dietary guideline. And so it's an incredibly important study. Ansel Keys led it. He went out to seven countries, including countries in Europe and the US and Japan, and studied nearly 13,000 men. And he found what he had hoped to find, because he already had an idea in his mind of what he thought caused heart disease, which is that people who ate very little saturated fat seemed to die less often of heart attacks. But it just turned out that there were so many methodological problems with this study that were not discovered until much later. And again, it's because this was a new field that wasn't really self-correcting, and he was it was a pioneering study. So, but later on, it was discovered, for example, he only chose countries, he sort of cherry-picked countries that would prove his hypothesis. So he chose Italy, Greece, Yugoslavia, where he had known from earlier work that they ate very little saturated fat and had low rates of heart disease. And he ignored countries such as France, Germany, West Germany, and Switzerland, where they ate a lot of saturated fat but also had low rates of heart disease. So So that influenced his study's outcome. And then because it was so hard to measure diet, as it still is today, but he only measured the diets of a tiny subsample of those 13,000 men, fewer than 500, it turns out, which is not statistically representative, a fact that he really took pains to hide in his final work. He didn't even report that number. I had to go digging around and find all kinds of obscure journals to actually get that number. And then in some cases, you know, the people on Crete who turned out, the island of Crete turned out to be his star subjects. They were peasants who tilled the soil until late at night, and they ate exceptionally low levels of saturated fat. 8% of their calories were as saturated fats, very little meat, cheese, butter, and they had low rates of heart attacks. But it turns out that in one of the three sample periods where he went there, he measured their diet during the Lent, the religious holiday, when they were conscientiously avoiding meat, cheese, butter, dairy, eggs. So he inevitably undercounted those foods. And that's just some of the few problems that I found when I went back and looked at that study. But it wasn't until much later, really in the last 20 years, that those errors have been found and discussed. And by then, it was really too late. I mean, that study set this whole ball rolling, and it was really the main study from the first, you know, from the 1950s and 60s. That was it, the seven-country study, cited again and again and again to underpin the idea that we should cut back on saturated fats and fat to prevent heart disease.
And it took hold. There's this kind of snowball effect, as you say, and it's become kind of ingrained now in American culture, in science, in the media. And it's interesting, you say that certain groups really came to kind of control the science that was being done. And if you weren't on that bandwagon, because there wasn't any funding available, if you didn't have a certain perspective, you couldn't do the science.
That is true. I mean, from the beginning, it was the American Heart Association that launched this diet. They remain one of the two most powerful groups issuing nutrition guidelines today. The other one is the USDA, of course. Those two groups have expert panels which guide them. They are made up of a small, what I call the nutrition aristocrats. They have kind of interlocking directorates, and they those experts are a small number of people who all – if you believed otherwise and if you didn't support the low-fat diet, you were disinvited from those panels. And they controlled – those organizations also controlled all the research dollars. Those nutrition aristocrats are the ones that sat on the editorial boards of journals. They conducted the studies for which those research grants were awarded. I mean – we spoke about George Mann, the one who – the scientist who went off to study the Maasai. He was, in fact, a very prominent scientist in the 1970s, was a director of a part of the Framingham study, one of the most important studies in the history of nutrition. And he was doing his own research, for which he received a grant from the National Institute of Health. And one day he was in – a secretary pulled him out into the hallway and said, "Dr. Mann, if you continue your opposition to Dr. Keyes, you will lose your research grant." And it turned out he did. So it's been very hard for critics to – science cannot be self-correcting if alternative viewpoints are not explored. You know, up until – it's still true that the National Institute of Health and the American Heart Association will not fund a high-fat, low-carbohydrate study. I mean, most commonly known as the Atkins diet. But they will not fund that – any research into that diet because they consider it too dangerous even to study. So the kinds of headlines that we see out now, this week there's a study, none of that – all of those were funded by alternative alternative organizations. I mean, the one out this week was funded by the National Cancer Institute because the part of the NIH that focuses on nutrition will still not fund and has not for decades funded any studies of the high-fat diet.
One of the things you really break down in the book also is the role of the vegetable oil companies, the role they played in kind of selling this diet heart hypothesis. Procter & Gamble really gave a lot of money to get the American Heart Association settled, going.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's such an interesting story how all these different factors intertwined to keep this diet heart hypothesis going. You know, there's the role of institutional investment and influence of big food companies and politics and bias. And, you know, they all intertwine. That's why my book has been called, my favorite line for it is, it's kind of a nutritional thriller, because it's just so fascinating how all these forces interwove with each other. The story of Procter & Gamble in 1948, the American Heart Association was a sleepy little professional society of cardiologists with almost no money at all. And Procter & Gamble approached them and said, we will make you the beneficiary of our Walking Man radio contest. And overnight, the American Heart Association, $1.7 million flowed into its coffers. Its own official history describes this as an incredible turning point. Suddenly it had money for research grants. It opened up chapters all over the country. It became the giant organization that it is today, and coincidentally started recommending that all Americans consume unsaturated vegetable oils, which was one of Procter & Gamble's main products, Crisco oil. So so the story of the vegetable oil companies is intertwined, and all the food companies, really. You know, the food manufacturing companies were intimately involved and still are in nutrition science, and that story is woven through this whole history.
One of the revelations of the book is that when you're talking about vegetable oils, that became the conventional wisdom then, that the alternative for fat, of course, is vegetable oil and olive oil, which we'll come back to, but let's talk about vegetable oil, because one of the revelations of your book is that polyunsaturated vegetable oils can be pretty devastating to health.
Well, again, they were not in the food supply in 1900, and they were introduced as Crisco, the very first kind of vegetable oil product, as an alternative to lard and butter. And that was a kind of hardened vegetable oil. You have to go; it has to go through this process called hydrogenation in order to make it hard. One of the reasons you want to make it hard is that makes it stable.
Right.
So oils are not stable. They oxidize, and especially when they're heated and especially over prolonged periods of time. So and when they're oxidized, it means that they chemically change. They bond with oxygen and create all kinds of toxic oxidation products, including things like acrolines and degraded triglycerides, all these oxidation products. More than 100 have been found in one piece of fried chicken alone. And those oxidation products, which were found, were originally researched in the 1940s when these oils became more common in the market. They were found to, in animal experiments on rats, to shorten their lives dramatically and lead to enlarged livers, cirrhosis of the liver. There was a lot of fear amongst certain members of the medical community that they were not healthy, and that the American Heart Association should pause before recommending them in case the cure were worse than the disease. But they remain, they remain very much in use. In fact, they're much more in use today, because when we got rid of trans fat, the trans-free oils, we've had to revert to just regular old vegetable oils like safflower, sunflower, peanut, soybean. And because they are trans-free, it's a little bit complicated. I won't go into it. But because they're trans-free, they are more unstable. Again, they're not hardened in order to make them more stable anymore, because we can't use – because trans fats are not allowed to be used anymore.
Let's talk about olive oil, which, as you point out in the book, has this reputation of, this ancient pedigree, and it has these disease-fighting powers. But I get a sense from you that you figured that hype has been a little overstated about olive oil.
Yes, there is, I think, a pretty unique chapter in my book about the Mediterranean diet, which is, I think, as far as I know, the first one really to explore the whole history of how it got launched. And, it turns out that the olive oil industry in Europe wanted to promote its product, olive oil, and decided that the way to do that was to fund a series of fantastic food science conferences all over the Mediterranean, which are known as like the best science conferences ever. All over, in beautiful sun-kissed Mediterranean countries in Greece and Italy and Tunisia, with scientists and food writers and chefs and government officials. And from that kind of series of blissful experiences emerged the enormous support for the Mediterranean diet. It is a better diet than the low-fat diet, perhaps because it's simply higher in fat. I mean, the Mediterranean diet, as Walter Willett from the Harvard School of Public Health said, it's like the USDA food pyramid with olive oil poured all over it. And that was a relief, a great relief to Americans who had been, you know, struggling with their non-fat diets and spraying pans with Pam. And so when olive oil arrived, it was like this great savior. Suddenly we had an acceptable fat that we could, that was tasty and good and we could, you know, we could use. But it's just not been shown subsequently. The science has not really supported the idea that olive oil has any special heart disease fighting powers. It seems like a healthy, good oil, probably better not to heat it because it has some of the same problems, although not to as much as other vegetable oils. But it doesn't seem to have any unique heart disease fighting powers, at least insofar as the science has been able to show.
Well, you say this about vegetable oil and olive oil. Here's how you put it in the book. You say this shift, you know, away from, you know, butter and lard to vegetable oils and olive oils, you say may one day be remembered as one of the greatest unintended public health mistakes in the history of manufactured food. Pretty strong.
It's kind of a big statement. But, you know, it is true that I mean, one of the unsung virtues of saturated fats like butter and lard and tallow, McDonald's used to fry its French fries in tallow,
yeah,
is that they're solid and stable. They do not oxidize even when heated. So they are – those are – that's an incredibly excellent, important quality about those fats. But because the nutrition, you know, experts have been uniquely focused – I mean, for decades, there have been papers that have looked at nothing but the effect of fatty acids, different fatty acids on cholesterol. There are thousands of studies looking at fat, cholesterol. Does it raise or lower HDL, LDL? They have ignored the fact that fats have a huge number of other biological consequences on your body other than cholesterol. So we've been living with this like blinders on, looking only at cholesterol. But fats also, they become incorporated into each and every cell membrane of your body. They influence, those fatty acid balance in your brain seems to influence your psychology. If you don't have enough of saturated fats and certain kind of fatty acid balances in your brain, it leads to depression and people who eat more vegetable oils in large clinical trials were shown to have higher rates of suicide and violent death that nobody could – they actually had meetings at the NIH to try to deal with that really concerning finding, but they could never explain it. So fats have all these other biological effects on your body that have just not been explored. And, you know, they're – whether or not they oxidize and lead to toxic oxidation products is one very important aspect of that.
We need to take another break, but I wanted to get a couple of questions here. I mean, a lot of what we're getting, or some of what we're getting anyway, I'd gotten some emails about sort of a lot of personal testimonials about people saying that they shifted to a high-fat diet and it's really been helpful for them. And then, of course, you get the other side of that, the sort of pushback of that. Catherine from Salt Lake City says that, you know, she brought down her cholesterol, she says, high cholesterol. She brought it down with a low-fat diet. And she says it's well demonstrated that if you give the bloodstream saturated fat, your liver will produce more cholesterol. Do you want to respond to that particular point?
So, again, your total cholesterol is not a good predictor of heart attack risk. Saturated fat causes your LDL to go up slightly, but again, LDL has also not been reliably linked to heart attack risk. Saturated fat is the only fat that makes your HDL, your good cholesterol, go up. And HDL has actually been a better predictor of heart attack risk. A diet that is high in fat and low in carbohydrates also dramatically reduces triglycerides and, again, leads to an improvement in the other up-to-date heart disease biomarkers like your LDL particle number and your LDL subfraction number. So total cholesterol turns out to not be a very good indicator.
And here's another question. It's a good one from Tim. Tim, I'm going to ask this for you because I think it's a good one. Back in the day when everyone was freaking out in the 40s and 50s about, you know, President Eisenhower's having all these heart attacks, do we know what was going on? What was the thing that boosted that? What was the problem?
Ah, excellent question. And my answer is no, we do not know. I think there are two, you know, a lot of things were changing, modernization. But what was changing in the diet were two major things. One is that, as I described, that ramp up in vegetable oils from zero to, you know, the 1940s and 50s. I don't know what exactly it was, but there was a dramatic shift of increased vegetable oil consumption and also an increase in sugar consumption. So I don't know. I mean, I think the science now is there's a lot of science to show that restricting carbohydrates improves people's heart disease markers, which is suggestive that it may have been the sugar and not the vegetable oils. But I think we really don't know the answer to that.
Thanks very much, Catherine. Thanks, Tim, as well. And we have Nina Teicholz with us. Her book is called The Big Fat Surprise, Why Meat, Butter, and Cheese Belong in a Healthy Diet. And we need to take another quick break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
KUER is listener-supported public radio. And our most dependable support comes from our nearly 9,000 sustainers, people just like you who make ongoing monthly contributions. Starting at just $5 a month, you can become a sustainer too. Go to KUER.org, click on the donate button, and tell us how you'd like to contribute. Use your credit card or make it even easier with a direct withdrawal from your bank account. Join our growing community of sustainers today at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Nina Teicholz, investigative reporter. Her book is called The Big Fat Surprise, Why Butter, Meat, and Cheese Belong in a Healthy Diet. She's joining us from a studio in New York City. So Nina Teicholz, I know you get this question a lot. I mean, what do you say to those who, you know, concede, okay, saturated fat is not bad for the human body, but they say, but agribusiness is bad for the environment or it's, you know, unethical. I mean, you choose not to say much about that. Not that it's not important, but as you say, you know, those questions are pretty complex and beyond the scope of your book. But how do you respond to that other part? Because that is the question sort of hanging out there in a lot of people's minds.
Yes, I think that the ethical and environmental questions are really huge. And I do respond and say, you know, it's taken me a decade just to get through the science to try to get to the bottom of the question, what is healthy?
Right.
What makes humans healthy? We still do not have anywhere near a expert consensus on that issue. And we first have to solve that problem. And then we can move on to figure out how to make whatever that is ethically and environmentally sustainable. I mean, the conversation so far has, you know, it's been all about how meat in raising cattle is bad for us, is bad for the environment, and also ethically unsustainable. And it's just so complicated. I mean, it's, you know, we have ramped up our fruit production enormously. That puts in it's a huge uses a tremendous amount of water. Water is a scarce resource. We the questions are so large, and also our discussion of them so far has been dominated by our own, I think, anti-meat bias that has really been strong in this country, so that we really don't have any kind of – I don't think we've had a clear discussion about it at this point.
You say in the book, unless you want to eat like an Italian peasant, drinking bowls of olive oil for breakfast, pretty much the only – possible way to consume enough fat for good health is to eat the saturated fats found in animal food. So, you know, whole fat dairy and eggs and meat, even fatty meat, of course. Talk a little bit about, because this you do mention there's a section in your book where you write about this case against meat. But what's the good part of that? Because you say that, you know, meat and eggs and whole fat dairy, that it's pretty dense in nutrients, more nutrient dense, you point out, than fruits and vegetables.
Right. I think that also reflects a kind of the fact that we don't know that also reflects the anti-meat bias that we've been living with for so long now. Because, in fact, meat and especially the organ meats that I was talking about earlier, they are exceptionally nutrient dense. They're far more dense in nutrients than fruits and vegetables, and they come packaged with the fat that you need to absorb many of those nutrients. You know, the fat-soluble vitamins A, D, E, and K can only be absorbed if you have the fat that goes with them. So if you're drinking skim milk, for instance, you're not able to absorb those vitamins, the vitamins A and D in milk, and without the vitamins, it becomes much harder to absorb the minerals in food. You need those vitamins. They work together with the minerals. So animal foods are like this perfect nutrient-dense package of both the protein and the fat that you need. Red meat is much more nutrient-dense than chicken, for instance. It also has iron, selenium, folate, zinc, which are not present in chicken in any significant amounts. Nobody knows that. We've been avoiding egg yolks, but, you know, egg yolks are actually where all the nutrients are. That's where you get the lutein. It's crucial for your eye health and casein. So, and also many more vitamins than, you know, than people who have just egg white omelets. So these foods are incredibly nutrient dense. And another part of them that I think is a fascinating aspect of these so-called, these kind of diet wars that we're having now between low fat and low carb. Fat and protein, for some reason that researchers really don't quite understand yet, are uniquely satiating. They fill you up. If you eat those foods, you don't seem to eat as much. You spontaneously reduce the amount of calories that you consume. I mean, another way of putting that, if you flip it on its head, is saying is that people can overeat quite a lot when they're eating carbohydrates. But in overfeeding experiments they did in the early 70s at the University of Vermont, and they put stacks of pork chops in front of subjects, the men would say, we simply cannot eat any more of those. We cannot eat them. And that's not true when you put a popcorn chips in front of people. They can overeat on those foods. So animal foods have all these important, really healthy aspects to them that really are not part of the conversation because we have been avoiding them solely on the basis of the fact that they contain saturated fats, which were thought to be – have so long been thought to be unhealthy for us.
Tristan, who sent in a question about why do when I eat full-fat dairy, does it make me feel fuller longer? There's an answer. Tristan, thanks for that. So let me ask you about – we've had a couple of questions about this China study that came out about a decade ago or so. What do you know about that, which seems to – and there are a number of these you also – you mentioned there are a couple of studies. Well, I think one from 2006, which kind of left, as you say, the nutrition field in a state of confusion. I mean, there are those – I don't know if you see them as outliers, but what do you make of those studies that suggest that, in fact, a low-fat diet can be healthy?
So the China study was a study by Colin Campbell, which he concluded that a diet low in animal fats. He's actually promotes a vegan diet based on that study. That study was an epidemiological study, like the seven country study, which ultimately could only show association and not causation. So those studies. That's the kind of study that can be used to suggest a hypothesis, but it cannot really be used as proof. But the people who are interested in that study, you know, they're interested in the vegan diet and the support for it, which turns out to be rather slim. I mean, the actual clinical trials, the kind of scientific study that can actually show proof, amount to really maybe one or two very tiny clinical trials. I mean, the one that Dean Ornish did was on 23 people, only 19 of whom finished his experiment, and it was multifactorial. So in addition to eating a very low-fat diet, they also had yoga, meditation, supplements, stress training. So it's really hard to know what led to their improvements. And again, 19 men, very hard to generalize to a larger population from that study. There's very little clinical trial evidence to show that a drastically low-fat diet will lead to better health.
I wanted to ask you about how do you get along with the paleo people? I mean, for the most part, they're right there with you, except of course the dairy part. We have a question from Bruce. Let me ask that. Who mentions milk contains a large biologically significant amount of steroid hormones. The dairy industry doesn't measure the quantities. Do you know anything about this? Maybe fold that into a response about this whole, you know, concern that dairy is bad for you, causes inflammation. I'm not sure what the argument is, but you want to respond to that?
Yes. I mean, first of all, I want to say that, you know, the quality of the animal foods that we get is not, you know, is inconsistent. And so, you know, if dairy farmers are now shooting their cows full of hormones, then that doesn't mean the milk itself is bad for health. It means that you should avoid that milk full of hormones. Same is true for meat. The paleo movement is really an enormous movement that has its own magazines and books, and it really arose out of a desire to try to mimic what the Paleolithic man ate, which did not in those days include dairy cows. So the reasoning is that dairy was not a part of that original meal plan for the human race. But they basically advocate, you know, a fairly low-carb diet, and I think that that's where the common ground is, and they all do not shy from meat. What I say about that is that, you know, it's very hard to know what Paleolithic man ate entirely because the archaeological record is so fragmented and hard to interpret and understand and measure. But we do have, I mean, just going back to this historical point that you brought up at the beginning, we do have 4,000 years of written history. Yeah. That tells us when humans coexisted and had livestock, and you know, butter is an ancient food, as is milk. So clearly, we coexisted with these foods, eating them in much better health than we are today. So I think there is a role for them. Why so many people now have, you know, are intolerant to dairy products may have nothing to do with the dairy products themselves. It may have to do with something else. But I think there is that historical record that is a pretty strong argument for them.
We're essentially out of time. I shouldn't ask you this, but I want to anyway. It's because one of the points you make near the end of the book is like the best part, which is that it's the pleasures of certain foods that have become forgotten for some. You know, eggs and fried butter and cream sauces and pan drippings. Less than a minute. Say something about that, because you say, what would our diets be like if we hadn't ditched the lard and the suet and the tallow?
You know, once you get over your fear of fat, it is so incredibly delicious to try these foods. I have gone back to old cookbooks from like 100 years ago and just tried some of these amazing how delicious is eggs fried in butter? These are like unknown pleasures from long, long ago. Meatballs and cream sauce. I mean, they're delicious. My final word.
Good. About meatballs.
And they're good for you.
That's right. Nina Teicholz, her book is called The Big Fat Surprise, Why Butter, Meat, and Cheese Belong in a Healthy Diet. Nina, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.